Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. When I was growing up in 1970s Britain, one of my favourite possessions was my two-part set of The Ladybird, Kings and Queens of England, the narrative structure on which my entire knowledge of history was built. And that's true, isn't it, Tom, of lots of people. So kings and queens are the sort of, they're still the kind of idiom.
Yeah, they're the scaffolding, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
But certainly you kind of work out English and then British history.
Absolutely. The Elizabethan age, the Georgians, the Victorians, you know, the Plantagenets, they are the sort of foundational, they're the foundation stones, aren't they?
Absolutely. Which is why I think that this World Cup that we've been doing, so we should explain to people who haven't caught up with all the fun and excitement. We've been running a World Cup of Kings and Queens of England. So from Athelstan all the way through to Elizabeth II, in our very first episode, we looked at the unexpected champion, who was actually Athelstan, the first king who can properly, I think, be called the King of England.
So lots of people commented, Tom, that were we basically saying that it had all been downhill since then?
I think that's a reasonable conclusion to draw, isn't it?
Yeah, you should write that article for Unheard. They get a bit of extra promotion.
Yes.
I hope they give us a bonus for that.
Yes, I should. Well, I haven't been asked, actually.
That's shocking. I can't believe that.
Well, no, actually, we were, weren't we? They did ask us. They asked us to write about Athelstan and Elizabeth I, and we couldn't because we were too busy.
And we were too busy or too lazy, depending on... I think we were genuinely too busy.
Anyway, so that was the first episode we did, and then we did the one that went out yesterday was on the losing contestants in the Super 16s round.
Yeah.
So now we come to the quarterfinals and the semi-finals, and the quarterfinals were Henry V against Elizabeth II, Henry VIII against William I, the Conqueror, Charles II against Elizabeth I, and Edward III against Athelstan.
Some big games there. Some very
massive
games.
Well, I mean,
matches.
You'd expect that, wouldn't you, in the quarterfinals of a major global tournament?
You would.
So the first match, Henry V against Elizabeth II. Henry V, a very proactive, dashing, charismatic king, smites the French against Elizabeth II, who's basically in this contest because essentially she's done nothing.
That's very harsh. She's done nothing, but in a very politically savvy way, I think.
Yes, she's done nothing very well. I mean, we'll come on to Elizabeth II and the way that 20th century, 21st century monarchy differs very radically, obviously, from, say, medieval exemplars. But Dominic, Henry V is absolutely the model of a warrior king.
Now, the issue is how much he's been created by Shakespeare, isn't it? So most people's image of Henry V comes from, well, it comes from sort of children's book illustrations with his bowl haircut.
His bowl haircut, and he's waving a sword, and he's got...
Always.
The leopards, the lions of England, and the fleur-de-lis, the surcoat.
Yeah, he's sort of scaling the walls at Harfleur. He's in the mud with all his bowmen at Agincourt. He's receiving a gift of tennis balls from the French, and does he throw them back, or he says... Because they say to him... Stay in England and play tennis, you wet weed. And he comes
and he
over
says and, that I will serve such a game
as has
never been seen in France before.
and
so he does, to be fair to him.
Now, there are one issue with Henry V is the trajectory of the story, which is irresistible, which is the sort of, in the popular imagination, he goes from this sort of laddish rogue hanging around with Falstaff, or indeed Sir John Oldcastle, who's the character that Falstaff is based on, to this sort of stern, rigorous, very pious, martial warlord.
Yes.
And that's kind of an invention, isn't it?
It's apparently a complete invention.
So he was never the sort of royster-doister who was falling out of taverns and consorting with
buffeting the ears of the Lord Chief Justice.
Yeah, that didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't. And obviously Falstaff didn't...
Exist.
So that whole I know thee not old man, banish, you know, he's become a responsible leader, banishing the follies of his youth. All of this is a myth. And I think, as you said, I mean, it absolutely points to the way in which Shakespeare has shaped and so you talked about the Ladybird books, and I agree that those kind of children's books that go through the Kings and Queens of England are massive, massive influences. But I think also that on the 15th century in particular, Shakespeare is an absolutely outsized influence on the way that people understand the kings of that period.
So Henry V and Richard III, they're the kind of polar opposites, aren't they?
Yeah, Yeah, so Richard III is the villain, Henry V is the absolute hero. But having said that, I mean, Henry V was clearly a very, very, by, you know, if you're saying martial success and ability to defeat the French is the measure of effective kingship, he was a very, very effective king.
Although you could argue he wastes a lot of resources in a war that ultimately England loses.
Well, you know that I think that.
So it avails us nothing in the long run. I mean, he wasn't to know that, though, was he? I mean, he wasn't to know that in the 1410s. Because he dies young at the age of 35 in 1422 of a combination of dysentery and heat stroke, having apparently subdued the French and secured his own claim to the French throne. When the French king dies, Henry will succeed him and unite France and England. But then he dies and it's all for nothing. But I suppose he wasn't to know that. I mean, he could have lived to the age of 55 and maybe, who knows? You know, a Franco-Anglo-French union of crowns? Or do you think that's just utterly laughable and implausible?
I don't think that would ever have happened. I mean, yeah. I just don't think the French would have accepted it. And I think that the resources of France were so vastly greater than those of England that, I mean, it was like those images you occasionally get from Australia or something of a snake trying to swallow an improbable, you know, kangaroo or something. And for a while it looks good, but then the kangaroo bursts.
It does happen, though. Some listeners will remember, for example, our Alexander the Great podcast, in which a small group of adventurers...
Yeah, but that didn't work, did it? The whole thing fell to pieces and disintegrated.
Well, but it changed the course of history. I mean, who's to say that France would have emerged as it did in the 16th and 17th centuries as such a superpower if it had been ruled by the English for longer?
Well, there were two options. Either the French, you know, in the reign of Henry VI... You know, if he succeeds when he's 40 or something, he'd still have been useless. They would have thrown English rule off.
Yeah.
Or you would have had a kind of Anglo-French condominium. But because France was so much richer, so much more sophisticated, so much classier, England would have ended up kind of supernumerary, I think.
Oh, dear, Tom. Well, that's terrible.
So essentially, I think there was no way that it would have been good.
And you're down on Henry V. Generally, aren't you?
Think he's the most overrated figure in English history.
Why?
Well, because I think that he squandered money. I think it was a essentially vainglorious episode. Shakespeare in his, you know, in his play, Henry IV's dying advice to Henry V, busy giddy minds with foreign troubles. That's basically what he's doing. Because the Lancastrian house, Henry IV, Henry of Lancaster, has deposed his cousin, Richard II, the son of the Black Prince, the grandson of Edward III. And that's a terrible thing to do. You can't go around deposing kings because these are anointed of God. So Henry IV labours under a kind of nagging anxiety that he has offended against God.
Yeah.
And I think Henry V is heir to that as well. So when Henry becomes king, he brings Richard II's body to Westminster Abbey and buries it with all due splendor. And again, Shakespeare on the eve of Agincourt has him kind of say, think not upon the fault my father made in compassing the crown, words to that effect. So there's this sense that even Henry has that God is going to punish the House of Lancaster at some point. And basically the whole, you know, it's a squalid campaign that goes vastly better than anyone could have anticipated. I mean, he's running enormous risk. He very nearly gets captured. That would then have bankrupted England because they would have had to pay his ransom.
Yeah.
I mean, it was absolutely irresponsible risk.
But he won.
He does win, but in the long run, England doesn't. And the blowback from their defeat in France is a crucial part. And of course, the blowback of the original Lancastrian usurpation results in the Wars of the Roses. So I think that Henry V is essentially putting a rather flamboyant sticking plaster on some rather deep wounds there.
Golly, that's harsh.
However, having said that, I mean, let's play devil's advocate. He's very dashing. So yes.
So Tom, just one quick question before we move on. I remember reading a book by the historian Ian Mortimer talking about Henry V and his road to Agincourt. And he painted Henry V as a ultra pious, almost a kind of a religious, you know, sort of a very kind of ascetic figure, very almost a religious kind of fundamentalist or something.
Kind of monkish.
Is that a bit overdone, do you think? Or is that true?
No, I think he was very, I mean, I think he was absolutely, and there's this awful story of him that, you know, this is the age of the Lollards.
Yes.
Kind of.
So they're proto-Protestants. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of them is being burnt, and he cries out to God, and Henry V hears him crying out to God, so orders the flames to be put out and asks if he's repented, and the Lollard says no. So Henry V orders the fires to be lit again.
Wow. Reburning,
so,
yeah.
Yes, sort of, robust attitude. However, I mean, to play devil's advocate, clearly he is a magnificent warrior. And yeah. One of the reasons why we know that he's not hanging out with Falstaff is that, basically he's been fighting since a very, very young age.
He fought at the Battle of Shrewsbury, didn't he?
Well, he's born in Monmouth, so he's on the Anglo-Welsh border. He fights at the Battle of Shrewsbury against Owen Glendower, who is a kind of, kind of proto-Welsh national leader, and against the Percys, who are the overmighty subjects from the north. And then, of course, he does, you know, I mean, there's no getting away from the fact he's very effective at fighting the French, which is, you've got to give him some credit for that, I suppose. He's also he's the first king to use English in his private correspondence since,
oh, that's nice.
Since 1066.
That's so a nice give him detail.
And he's been the hero of some fabulous films. I mean, I think the Olivier film is brilliant. It still holds up.
The Branagh film is...
very good. I tell you, a terrible film is the Timothy Chalamet one. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
That got
quite laudatory reviews, as I remember.
No, it was awful. They rewrote Shakespeare. John Falstaff in that one doesn't die, and he accompanies Henry V to France. And at some point, Timothy Chalamet turns to John Falstaff and says, John. John Falstaff says, yes. And Henry V says, John, I just want to thank you for being you.
Oh, no. You're kidding. He's serious.
Yeah, that's what they got rid of Shakespeare's immortal verse.
Oh, my word.
I don't want to sound old-fashioned, but...
No.
That's not an advance, is it?
That's definitely not an advance. All right, so that's Henry V. Let us move on to another larger-than-life character. The larger-than-life character in all English history. Probably the monarch... I mean, I think we said this the other day on the yesterday's podcast, that this is the monarch who is best known around the world, and that is, of course, Henry VIII. Six wives, gargantuan appetite, break with Rome, you know, capricious... charismatic, magnetic personality, a great lover of tennis, of music, of dressing up in hoods, a great Bullingdon man. So hopefully you'll be doing your impersonation. a tremendous
the hero of a top book.
A top children's book. Well, you say the hero.
Well, no,
you see,
not
Henry
really,
VIII, I think in a funny way, I think he's a little bit underestimated. Because I think the one thing people never appreciate with Henry VIII, who is, of course, the king at the beginning of the first part of the 16th century, the great Reformation king, is how insecure his position is when he takes over. Because you're talking about being the son of a usurper. I mean, he too is the son of a usurper in Henry VII, who's won the crown on the battlefield. And Henry VIII and his stuff with his six wives and all the sort of beheadings and whatnot, that only makes sense if you understand it against the background of the Wars of the Roses and the insecurity of his position.
Family tree shenanigans, as I think the phrase he used yesterday.
Family tree shenanigans. Yeah. I think Henry VIII I think he gets a bit of a bad press. I mean, obviously he was terribly fat. He was capricious, all these things. But
well, he becomes fat, doesn't he?
But all king. I mean, I was only reading that we will be discussing Edward III later on. He becomes very fat and old and capricious. So... with Henry VIII, I think what people underestimate is the extent to which people at the time thought he was the model of a king. Don't you? Or am I being too kind?
I think that the reason for Henry VIII's celebrity is clearly partly his wives, and we've done a whole episode on them, and it's this kind of idea of him as a blue beard, a wife murderer, and that gives him the quality of an ogre. I mean, literally an ogre. And we don't actually have many ogre-ish kings. I mean, we've had frightening kings. So Edward I is clearly a frightening king. Mm. Richard I is a frightening king. Cromwell, in his own way, is a kind of a frightening, intimidating figure. But Henry VIII is I mean, he's a proper tyrant, but he's a glamorous tyrant. And I think it's that blend of glamour and tyranny. I mean, he's the one that's closest to a Nero or a kind of, that model of a Roman emperor. It's the charisma and the bloodiness that combines. And I think so Froissart, who we'll probably come on to when we talk about Edward III, great French historian of the 14th century, says of the English that basically they're very, very disrespectful towards their kings, and they expect their kings to do what they want them to do. And that kings exist on sufferance in England, which is a striking thing for him to say, three centuries before execution of Charles I. Henry VIII, you've said how precarious his position is when he begins, but he really wrests it round. And what he does to the Roman Church, what he does to the aristocracy, what he does to anybody who dares to stand up to him. I mean, he is a tyrannical figure.
But the contrast to that is obviously the previous century. So the Wars of the Roses and Henry VI. So a 16th century monarch, you look back at the recent past and you say, well, we had this dreadful drip in Henry VI, who was very kind, who thought about God, who was very nice to small children and animals. And he was an absolute dead loss. The barons were completely out of control. There was anarchy and civil war and all this sort of stuff. And you have to be formidable. And also Henry VIII is living in an age of, as we talked about before, of incredibly formidable kings. So Francis of France, King Francois, or Charles V, the Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of Spain. I mean, they are titanic figures.
But it's a tribute to Henry, isn't it, that he can even be mentioned in the same breath? I mean, England is such a kind of second division power compared to France or the Empire. The very idea of comparing them is kind of comical. So that also is a tribute to his charisma, I think.
And he's also consequential in a way that is not true of all the monarchs on this list. I mean, you mentioned Elizabeth. We'll come to Elizabeth II. Let's be frank. Even the greatest admirer of the Queen could not possibly claim that she is a really consequential monarch. She's a uniting figure, and she's consensual and all that stuff, but she hasn't changed anything. Henry VIII changes the entire destiny of the country, because of course it's not in, given that France had been a hotbed of Protestantism, but ends up as a Catholic country, ends up as the exemplar of sort of Catholic absolutism. It's not inevitable that England will be Protestant. I mean, it could easily have remained loyal to the Roman Church.
No. And England was famously devoted to the Church of Rome, to the Virgin, always had been. And actually, of course, one of the key symbolic moments in Henry's reign is when he orders the desecration of the shrine of Thomas Becket, who we talked about in reference to Henry II,
played by some absolutely top class actors,
some top actors who missed their vocation. I mean, Becket posthumously is the victor over Henry II, but Henry VIII, he smashes up Thomas Becket's tomb, has his relics, burnt and chucked into the river. I mean, Henry triumphs over Becket. Yeah. I remember I met an American Jesuit who was over in England, I think for a year or something. And he was telling me that he'd been to Windsor and he'd been to the chapel where Henry VIII is buried. And there was obviously kind of ropes around the tomb. And he said that when no one was looking, he jumped over the ropes and danced on Henry VIII's tomb.
Oh my God. That's a bit much.
So there are still deeply felt wounds.
Yeah.
But of course, another paradox of Henry's role is that in the long run, his reign proves to be a turning point in the relationship of the monarchy to Parliament.
Yeah.
Or well, is it because an old-fashioned view?
I think, that's controversial among his.
I know it's controversial, but I think it's indisputable that Henry's reign does not damage the reputation and the potency of Parliament.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, let's phrase it like that.
And also Henry, he's an ambiguous figure because he is himself deep down theologically still quite Catholic, isn't he? So I had when we were doing the World Cup on Twitter, I posted a facetious tweet that Henry had invented tennis, music and Protestantism. And lots of people replied saying he wasn't even a real Protestant. he didn't actually invent music either.
Luther thought he was... I mean, obviously, he had a bust up with Luther because he'd written a defense of the papacy, of the Church of Rome, which is why Defender of the Faith remains the title of the British monarch to this day. But even once he'd broken with Rome, I mean, Luther thought that he was mad. That Henry had basically proclaimed himself God.
Yeah. Which he effectively, he proclaims himself God's vicegerent in his own kingdom, doesn't he? And then gets Cromwell to smash up the monasteries for him because he wants the money. So the fascination of Henry's reign is that, to me, the fascination is that perfect combination of kind of opportunism, of avarice, of political calculation in a context of genuine, evangelical fervor. And it's the interaction of those things that makes it such a fascinating story. And then you put the wives on top of that and the court machinations and stuff. And it becomes this, you can understand why Hilary Mantel, why Shakespeare, why legions of kind of novelists have found all this so, so fascinating. Because I think more than any other monarchical story in our history, it has a cocktail of every possible ingredient.
It's interesting that some of our greatest writers have detested him. So yeah. Charles Dickens in his Children's History, the plain truth is that he was a most intolerable ruffian, a disgrace to human nature, and a blot of blood and grease upon the history of England. Jane Austen, Henry VIII's, his only merit was his not being quite so bad as his daughter Elizabeth.
Oh, golly, that's harsh.
Tracy Borman wouldn't like that, would she?
Tracy Borman would be absolutely outraged. But you see, Hilary Mantel, one of the things I think that was really good about Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall sort of trilogy, which I do think actually, like a lot of people, went on a bit too long, is that it captures the magnetism of Henry. He is an attractive person to be around, particularly at first. He is an exciting person. And I think that's absolutely how he must have seemed. He was a giant, wasn't he? And he's brilliant at all these things. He is brilliant at sport. He speaks five languages. He's fascinated by scientific instruments.
Yes.
Yeah, obviously
he's a Renaissance prince.
Yeah, he's an absolute Renaissance prince.
But isn't it a bit like Victoria that we were talking yesterday about how she goes from Gemma Coleman to
yes,
this kind of
Judy Dench.
Judy Dench.
With no intervening period.
Yes. And it's the Judy Dench period that dominates.
Yeah.
And with Henry, I suppose because of Holbein. So again, Dickens is brilliant on this. And he says that he's talking about when he was 18. He says, people said he was handsome then, but I don't believe it. He was a big, burly, noisy, small-eyed, large-faced, double-chinned, swinish-looking fellow in later life, as we know from the likenesses of him painted by the famous Hans Holbein. And it is not easy to believe that so bad a character can ever have been veiled under a prepossessing appearance.
To think of him as having gone from kind of Jude Law to Johnny Vegas.
Yes.
With no intervening period.
But it's Johnny Vegas. It's that incarnation that we imagine, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, it's the kind of fat. And Dominic, did was there perhaps a treatment that his physicians gave him that has been mentioned in a top children's book?
And top podcast, I think we talked about it. Didn't we talk about it in the podcast?
Yeah, we did. But I wondered whether perhaps you'd like to.
Well, listeners may remember that Henry's doctors had to insert a silver tube into his bottom and squirt him with a mixture of herbs and milk and honey from a pig's bladder.
Yes.
A treatment that I've never tried, but some
we
listeners...
We could do it live on the podcast.
We could. When we do our top 10 enemas, then we can culminate with a live
squirting from a pig's
bladder.
Maybe
we'll invite the worst guest we've had. We'll choose our worst guest. And subject them to this treatment. That's a lovely image. Right, let's move on. Tom is laughing too much to talk, so I will take command of the podcast. We should take a break, and we'll come back with Charles II after the break.
But you know, we're in a Rachel Morley situation, because we've only done two, and we've got to do four more.
That's because we got sidelined by ludicrous...
Top 10 enemas and things.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, we won't do that in the second half. We'll be much more responsible. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Now, while you were listening to the ads, Tom was actually trying out that enema treatment, and he's back now. He looks refreshed, cleansed.
I do. Yes. Purged,
he's a new man.
I think is the word.
Purged, exactly. So, Tom, a great character.
The third quarterfinal, Charles II against Elizabeth I. Elizabeth I absolutely murdered Charles II. Elizabeth I did to Charles II what Cromwell would have liked to do.
Yeah.
Dispatched him. So Charles II was a seed, mainly thanks to your advocacy and Tracy Bullman. I would not have had him as a seed. I would have had Cromwell as a seed, I think. But he's a kind of an attractive figure.
He's a great character.
He's a character, isn't he? So he's the son of Charles I.
Yeah.
Civil War. At the end of the Civil War, he goes into exile. He comes back, tries to launch an invasion of England from Scotland. Gets defeated at the Battle of Worcester by Cromwell. Has to rush around hiding in oak trees and things.
Yeah.
Sails away from Shoreham. Spends the rest of Cromwell's protectorate in the Netherlands, and then in 1660 is restored.
Yeah, and issues the Declaration of Breda, so he comes back promising kind of
liberty, relative, tender consciences.
Yeah, relative tolerance and sort
of... Although it is relative, isn't it? Because 1662, the Act of Uniformity, is a kind of...
Yeah, exactly. Which, there is the Clarendon Code, which is seen as a sort of an attempt to institute Anglicanism and to be a bit more intolerant to people who are outside the
dissenters,
to dissenters, exactly. Yeah. And then he's involved in a series of very high profile events. So obviously there's the Great Fire of London, there's a plague, there is what some historians traditionally have seen as the birth of politics with the exclusion crisis, when Parliament tries to get rid of exclude his brother James, Duke of York, from the succession because he's a Catholic, and you get the first vestiges of kind of factional of factions coalescing into Whigs and Tories. But it's also Charles's,
and I should mention, because our Dutch followers are always going on about this, but apparently there was some war between England and the Dutch Republic that the Dutch won, but that sounds very improbable.
I think we should give that no thought at all.
Anyway, listen, we'll just draw a veil over that and not even mention it.
But
you've been to the Rijksmuseum.
I have, yeah. I've seen all those paintings of naval victories that I've never heard of.
Absolutely astonishing. I know, you go in, it's just full of paintings of the Dutch beating the English. It's absolutely shocking. It should be allowed, isn't it?
They're just minor skirmishes, aren't they, in English waters, I think.
Ludicrously overinflated. Yeah. So we don't know what the Dutch are going on about. Anyway, so let's focus on more important things, because, of course, the most famous thing about Charles II is that he had lots of mistresses.
He did. Nell Gwyn. He had, who was... As I recall from 1066 and all that, was she selling oranges?
She was, and she was one of the top 10 mistresses.
Was she?
That you missed because you were malingering.
Yes. Yeah, there's Barbara Villiers, Lady Castlemaine.
Yeah,
there's,
she's great. And Pepys sees her underwear.
He does. He's very excited by it, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
There's Louise de Kerouaille, the Duchess of Portsmouth.
And there's Francis Stuart, who resists his importunities, and she then becomes the model for Britannia. On the coinage.
That I didn't know. That's a good fact. He's also a great scientist. So he's very interested in science. He's instrumental, obviously, in the Royal Society and in the Royal Observatory. In January 16th, there's a great entry in Pepys's diary, Tom. Pepys meets Charles II in the park, going for a walk with his brother James. And they go afterwards to the King's Little Elaboratory. So a place where you elaborate.
Yes.
So that's where the laboratory comes from, which I didn't know. So you go and elaborate that. Did you know that?
No, that's the great thing about this podcast. I'm learning new things.
We're learning all the time. So Pepys said it was a pretty place, and he there saw a great many chemical glasses and things, but understood none of them, which is exactly how I felt as a teenager.
Science lessons.
Doing science. Yeah.
Yes. And Prince Rupert was a keen chemist
very
as well.
Absolutely.
So
the Stuarts, they're great scientists.
Great scientists, but also, we should mention this, also a great enthusiast for the slave trade.
Yes, as well.
So yes, Rupert was definitely involved in it. And
was Charles II involved in the slave trade?
I think he was. I think he was an investor in...
An investor. But let's face it, if you're in the Stuart court in the mid-17th century, everyone's an investor, right?
Okay, but I think just mention that, because that was something that I saw kind of bubbling up.
Did you? I didn't see that. Yeah. I don't follow that part of Twitter. It may amaze you
I was just scanning through, seeing what people were saying about all the various kings. And that was... So looking at the negatives as well as positives, and that's... I mean, I guess it's kind of up there with wiping out Irish towns, expelling the Jews, and investment in the slave trade are still
seen as no-nos.
They're black marks.
The big thing at the time, of course, so he signs a secret treaty with Louis XIV, in which Louis XIV basically says he will pay him £230,000 if Charles A joins that war with the Dutch, which is a shambles, which you mentioned earlier,
which we're crossing a veil over
secretly. if he converts to Catholicism and will come out as a Catholic and lead England towards Catholicism, something that Charles actually has no intention of doing.
But he does on his deathbed, doesn't he? He converts.
Supposedly he does on his deathbed, exactly. So clearly Charles had, shall we say, papal sympathies. And he takes this money from the French. And this has sometimes been held against him by kind of Protestant Whiggish historians, but who also see him as conniving and weasel-like and not setting a clear direction and stuff. I mean, I would say he's a brilliant politician who, in very troubled times, is actually a very popular king and manages to hold onto his position. And yeah, I think
He faces the same problem that his father had, which is that he doesn't have the money.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why he takes the money from the French.
Yes. And so rather than kind of, you know, fight a civil war over it, because he's learned from his dad that possibly not the best policy. Yes. And that's the thing that that Rochester, the Earl of Rochester, who's a fabulously scabrous poet.
Have you got a quotation? Well,
I've got the famous one. I mean, this is a poem about Charles II that Rochester wrote, which is so rude that I can't read it because we'll lose all our sponsors.
Yeah.
But the concluding line has the famous phrase, "Restless he rolls about from whore to whore, a merry monarch, scandalous and poor." And people always remember the merry monarch and the whores and the scandal and things. But it's the poverty, isn't it, really?
That underpins a lot of these decisions.
Yeah,
but, Tom, he is a merry monarch. I mean, we haven't talked massively about what it is to be a king. And so much of it is about presentation, spectacle, performance, iconography. Charles II ticks all of those boxes.
He's a very, like Henry VIII, I suppose, or Henry V, you immediately know who he is when you see him.
Great. Absolutely. He looks like a spaniel, basically.
Spaniel, yes. Yeah. And well, like a King Charles II spaniel.
Yeah.
Indeed.
But he plays the part brilliantly. He's a very canny politician. He doesn't allow his opponents to outsmart him. There's a brilliant book by Jenny Uglow called A Gambling Man, where the motif is about cards and playing cards. And Charles II is a brilliant card player. He knows what card to play at the right time. He always stays in the game, unlike his brother James, who was kicked out after only 3 years, and unlike his father. So of all the Stuarts, to me, I know we're fans of James I on this podcast, but he is the most magnetic and in many ways the most impressive.
Did he not say about James II, about James, that no one would murder him, Charles, to make him king? I mean, that's quite waggish.
Yeah. Yeah,
would you say that of all the monarchs we've talked about, he's the one who's most like Boris?
That's very good. Yes, I hadn't thought of that, but he is very Boris-like. But I was just about to say, he's probably, of all the monarchs on this podcast, who would you go for a drink with? Charles II's got to be up there.
Yeah, you'd be frightened to have a drink with Edward I, wouldn't you?
I wouldn't have a drink with...
Spill his pint.
I wouldn't go for a drink with Richard the Lionheart or something. I mean, he wouldn't even tell me.
Smacking you on the... That'd be terrifying.
Yeah. Or Knut, I mean...
Well, I don't know.
And a beachside
barbecue.
No, yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, we're waffling. Let's... Charles II, I think quarterfinals is about right. I actually expected him to reach the semis because of the sheer magnetism of the Merry Monarch, but he didn't. Crashed out to Elizabeth I. Maybe with a different draw, he could have gone further. However, he didn't get a different draw. So the next monarch to crash out was Edward III.
Against Athelstan.
Beaten by Athelstan. So Edward III, he was king for 50 years. I mean, by medieval standards, a colossal, absolutely colossal.
Well, he was 14 when he became king.
He was, wasn't he?
So and his mum and her partner, her lover.
Do that again? That was very good.
Lover. had disposed of dad, Edward II.
Yes, horrifically.
Unpleasantly. Everyone knows, so we won't go on about it.
Yeah.
Oh, you were just about to.
Yeah, I was. I was about to say, well, it's a poker, isn't it? It's the insertion of a poker.
Yes.
That's the claim, but I think that a lot of more serious, scrupulous historians say that probably is just a total invention.
So we'll say it happened.
Yeah. So they're Roger Mortimer and Isabella, and Edward basically turns against them when he grows up a little bit more, doesn't he? And gets rid of them, and Roger Mortimer is hanged, I think.
So I always loved Edward III. I think we talked about this before, the Conan Doyle's novels about chivalry.
Is it the White Company?
White Company, Sir Nigel, which at the time didn't seem funny to me at all. I absolutely loved them, and Edward III is such a kind of dashing figure in them. He's a model of a...
Yeah.
But
he's slightly, do you not think he's slightly, to people who are not experts on the 14th century, Edward III just seems like a slightly generic, bearded English king. He fights the French. He's very chivalrous.
Yes. Well, what's wrong with that?
No, nothing is wrong with that. But
surely
I find
you're not complaining about that.
I'm not complaining, but I find him quite hard to pin down what's distinctive about him.
Well, he lays claim to the French throne.
Yeah.
Again, absolutely unjustifiably. But what the hell?
So they've confiscated Aquitaine, haven't they? The French. That's the pretext for all this, or that's the trigger.
Well, no, he's claiming it's all to do with the Salic law.
Well, there's a bit of that.
It's descent through the female line, which, according to French law, doesn't count, and he says it does. Anyway, it's all just an excuse to have a massive romp, and the English defeat the French at the naval battle of Sluys, and then they have the Battle of Crecy, where they unleash the longbow.
Great moment.
So, and it's kind of heartwarming. It's the union between stirring chivalrous knights and kind of horny-handed Sambrook figures.
Yeomen, I think is the word.
With their longbows. And it's all utterly chivalrous. And the Black Prince, his son, is it's his first big battle. He's coming under pressure. People come and ask Edward III, should we go to his rescue? And he says, no, let the boy win his spurs. And he does win his spurs.
Great moment.
And he kills the blind king of Bohemia and takes Ich dien, I serve, his motto, which is still the Prince of Wales' motto to this day. And it's all utterly chivalrous. And then in due course, the Black Prince wins the Battle of Poitiers as well, in exactly the same way. And he actually captures the French king.
Yeah.
Edward III has captured both the Scottish and the French king. You know, it's all, you know, what's not to like? It's all utterly chivalrous and heroic. However, there are two massive downsides. One is the Black Death, which obviously is not good news.
That's not really his fault, though. I mean, he can't.
No, it's not.
He should have locked down earlier.
Well, but I mean, it's like COVID kind of interrupting the sports fixtures. It interrupts the Hundred Years' War. So they have to kind of stop the Hundred Years' War. You know, we'll play it in kind of empty stadiums.
Behind closed doors.
Yes, behind closed doors. So the Battle of Crecy is before the Black Death, and Battle of Poitiers comes, you know, they're emerging out of lockdown. But the other thing that stands against Edward III is that he ends up very kind of senile and under the thumb of a sinister mistress called Alice Perrers.
Alice Perrers. Is she sinister, or is that just put about by
her? It's all put about. I don't know. I mean, but there's the definite sense that actually, a bit like with Henry V, the whole idea of invading France is basically a disastrous idea, and that no matter how successful some of the battles might be, the whole thing in the long run will lead to a kind of meltdown, which is what happens in England because peasants revolt, misery.
But Tom, it's a very important reign, isn't it? Because it sees the triumph of chivalry. It sees English being used in law courts and in parliament.
Chaucer,
of course. Yep. So it feels like, is it wrong to see it as a, well, how can it be a golden age when a third of the population has been killed by the Black Death? But people do see it as, I mean, obviously Sir Arthur Conan Doyle saw it as a bit of a golden age, didn't he?
I think it kind of merges with a vague, hazy idea of King Arthur.
Frassar said, didn't he, that Edward III was such a king as had not been seen since the days of King Arthur.
Yes, and there's the whole, he establishes the Order of the Garter. Honi soit qui mal y pense, evil be to he who evil thinks. Honey, you've lost your garter, as 1066 transcribes it. So I think there's a kind of a general, a bit like Henry V, there's a kind of aureate glow around it. But also when I think of it, I think of it as, so if I'm kind of imagining Edward III's reign, I'm thinking a bright sunny morning, glorious midday, and then the clouds start to roll in.
Then plague.
And plague, and it all goes wrong.
So the historian Norman Cantor said of Edward III, he was an avaricious and sadistic thug.
I'm sure he was.
But that's what people wanted, isn't it? That's the mark of great kingship in the medieval period. To booty for your mates and you know, bashing the French.
Which again, I think kind of highlights the way that in this World Cup, we are, every monarch has to be judged by the standards of the age in which they rule. And I suppose ultimately what's being judged is whether they're iconic.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. So talking of avaricious and sadistic thugs, we're now on to the semi-finals. And the first semi-final saw Athelstan. It was a sort of, you know, it was an Anglo-Saxon Norman rematch, wasn't it? It was Athelstan against William the Conqueror. And at that point, when I saw Jonathan Wilson make the draw, it was blindingly obvious to me that Athelstan would make the final. Because William the Conqueror is a man who is respected, but I think fair to say, not loved.
No, and I'm amazed, actually, that he got this far. And I think it's really interesting, the fact he did get this far, what it says about, well, about how Hastings is viewed, actually.
But he's being rewarded here. Nobody, I mean, if you asked English people in the street, do you wish the Anglo-Saxons had won the Battle of Hastings? They would probably say yes, wouldn't they? The Anglo-Saxons are romantic. They are the underdogs in the Battle of Hastings. But he is being—he's the sort of Margaret Thatcher of this competition.
Yeah, but if you said, but if you said, we lost the Battle of Hastings.
Yeah,
I don't think people would say that. I mean, you might say, you know, an English person might say, "We won the Battle of Waterloo" or "We won the Battle of Britain." But yeah. would we say we lost the Battle of Hastings? I don't think we would, because I think we recognise that actually, what William brought was so formative for England that it's become a part of what it is to be English. And obviously that's the case with the monarchy. The monarchy is more Norman, perhaps, than it is Anglo-Saxon.
You mean because it's the Anglo-Saxon monarchy was more, what, was more elective, more consensual, more low-key?
The antiquity and the dignity of the Anglo-Saxon monarchy is very, very important to William. It's part of the loot of England. It's part of what he wants. The fact that it is, dare I say, sacral. You become as Duke of Normandy, he's not an anointed ruler. As King of England, he is. So that's very important. But the fact that basically we date kings from 1066.
Yeah.
So we've said that, you know, there are three King Edwards before Edward I, but he is the first Edward.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think it reflects the fact that essentially we see William as the founder of the English monarchy in a way that obviously is ahistorical, but reflects a kind of deep truth of just how significant William's reign is. And that therefore, in a sense, he is seen as not just a kind of alien invader, perhaps in the way that Canute is, but as a legitimate king of England.
It's partly because of the Domesday Book, isn't it? Because the Domesday Book is seen as one of the foundational texts of English government and of English identity, actually.
Also, I think, the castles that he and his followers planned across England, they've kind of also become representative of the Middle Ages for people.
Yeah.
So if you have a castle and the great cathedrals, of which Durham would be the kind of the first, that these for most of us, I think, are kind of visual symbols of what England is. And because we don't have Anglo-Saxon equivalents, that's another reason, I think, why the Anglo-Saxon period is so much more shadowy.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think that's very true. I think there's also, with William, though, there's the issue of his, shall we say, his bastardy. So he was called William the Bastard because he was illegitimate, and he's seen to have behaved like a bastard.
He was a bastard, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Harrying Northerners, smiting people.
Well, again, so a definite sense from Twitter engagements that people in the North have not forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was a kind of near genocidal repression of rebellion in the North.
I mean, can you make a case for him and say he's ruthless and that's what he has to be? I mean, he lives in a ruthless age where you win by the sword, and if you don't, you die. I mean, that's surely the case you'd make, that he's a strong leader, and any successful regime in in the 11th century, you have to be really stern.
Yes, I think so. But even his own followers, so Audric Vitalis, mm-hmm. who's very admiring of him generally, says of the harrying of the North that with this, I can't justify this. This was a terrible thing.
So even by the standards of his own time, he's seen as repressive, autocratic.
Yeah. And I think the great abbey he builds on the site of Hastings, the Battle of Hastings, is also a monument to that, because that's built as a way to try and expiate the crime that he committed in killing so many people. So I think that kind of strange, which you also have in Henry V, the strange combination of kind of martial brutality and piety, you absolutely get in William.
Yeah.
And neither of those are very popular qualities at the moment.
Well, that's why the story that everybody enjoys about William is his funeral. So he's died in Normandy, and his body is sort of expanded with gas, hasn't it? Isn't that right?
That
he's
right.
Sort of swollen. They're trying to shove his body into the coffin. That's basically too small for it. He's become an enormous fellow. They shove him in and he bursts, and his entrails fall out with a terrible stench.
That's right.
And everybody, doesn't everybody run out of the church in horror or something? So it's a very undignified end. Harold Godwinson's revenge, I think we could call it.
And he's buried next to his wife, Matilda, who everyone says is very small, but actually wasn't.
Wasn't she?
No, she wasn't, apparently.
Why do people say it then?
Because their graves got rifled in the French Revolution, and I think bits have got kind of lost. Right. So people thought she was basically 4 foot. She was absolute midget.
Well, but they don't realise that the rest of her is missing.
They've kind of gone back and worked out that actually she was of absolutely average height.
Okay. Well, this is fascinating stuff. An average-heighted woman, yes. Not a small one. Yeah. Right, so we have one other semi-final loser, don't we? So we had the Elizabeth Derby, Elizabeth I against Elizabeth II. Yet again, Elizabeth I won an absolutely crushing victory. And Elizabeth II, now you said that she'd done nothing. I mean, she hasn't done nothing, but she's done little by comparison with her predecessors.
She's had done to make nothing fewer in a choices, positive way.
Hasn't she?
Yeah. She's been positively boring.
Yes, she's been very canny in her boringness, I think. And she has, you know, God, I mean, I do so many kind of Channel 5 talking head things about the 20th century monarchy. My heart really isn't in
okay,
saying
well,
yet again.
Okay, well, go on. Well, just saying, what's your
saying
take
yet
on
again,
that?
You know, she's managed the, she's navigated the shoals. Oh, yeah. Great friends with Harold Wilson, you know, Silver Jubilee. I could do it. To be honest, I'd just hear my own voice droning in my sleep when I'm doing all this stuff. My agent will be absolutely livid with me for saying this, doing myself out of, you know, 101 top Elizabeth II moments on Channel 4 in 2027 or whatever. Anyway, do you want to talk about the Queen, Tom?
Well, I think, so if we say we have to judge monarchs by, you know, if we're judging their success by the standards of the age in which they live, I would say that there's a case for saying Elizabeth II is the most successful monarch Britain's ever had.
Well, if you're judging, but you're judging by such different standards, aren't you? I mean,
yeah, of course. So she hasn't changed the course of English history. She hasn't won, you know, hasn't defeated the French. Hasn't changed the religion or anything like that. But her role as constitutional monarch has been to serve as a figurehead for the nation.
And you should do these documentaries instead of me.
I know I should, but for me, I haven't actually really thought about this before. So for me, it's all fresh. So okay. You can just kind of barrack me on the side.
Yeah.
But what you'd say about the decades of her reign is that they have been remarkably convulsive. It's hard to think of a time where people's understanding of say morals or ethics have changed so radically.
Oh, the 16th
and we've
century?
Discussed that before.
I mean, that's culturally convulsive. Come on, Reformation.
I think attitudes to sex, to gender, to race have changed so profoundly. And I think also what's interesting is that they have changed in ways that objectively should be very destabilizing to the idea of a hereditary monarchy, because the idea of a kind of authority and privilege oppressing those who historically have been underprivileged has become an absolute no-no. I mean, that's what kind of has driven the feminist revolution, the giving to gay people of, you know, basically rights equivalent to heterosexual people, the anxieties about racism. That all of these you would thought would be threatening to the idea of the fact that our head of state rules by virtue of her descent from a long line of monarchs who ultimately go back to Woden. You'd think, you know, this is, you know, there's nothing obvious about the fact that people would continue to accept this. And, you know, I think by and large people do. And so by that standard, I would say that Elizabeth's achievement has been astonishing. And I think the reason why she's been successful isn't just because she's, you know, she's accepted that being boring is basically what her job has been, but also that she really believes it. She takes it very, very seriously. Mm. And I think that it's absolutely essential for the success of monarchy that monarchs themselves take what they're doing very, very seriously.
Yeah, you couldn't be a flippant monarch, could you?
You couldn't be a kind of Charles II type monarch now. You have to take it seriously. You have to be earnest about it. And Elizabeth II really does. She really does think that she's been appointed by God, I think. And that's what makes me wonder whether the institution will last very long after her.
I always think it will. I think well, let's not get into prognostications of the future, but
well, what I would say is that one of the other things that we've talked about is how children can be problematic for reigning kings.
Yeah,
I think Charles is fine, but I think, for instance, Andrew is a shocker. I think he's like a kind of great cancer at the heart of people's acceptance of the monarchy, because a kind of thick, entitled perv is not a good look for any king. You know, even
I think English even history has been littered with thick, entitled.
I know, pervs. But they generally they haven't gone down well. I think Andrew is a kind of reminder to people of what monarchy can serve up to you.
Yeah, I think I would say in sort of agreement with you is, first of all, the Queen is probably the most popular monarch Britain has ever had, because by her nature, she's not divisive. I mean, she hasn't had to make the divisive choices that a previous, more powerful monarch would have had to have made. So her prime ministers have been divisive, but she hasn't. And she probably leaves the monarchy on firmer foundations than would have seemed possible under any other post-1950s monarch. It's hard to imagine how somebody could have left it in a better state, as it were. So yes, but she is boring. Yeah, I mean, this is partly a tournament about iconography and about, are you iconic? Are you remembered?
I think the Queen is iconic.
Well, she is iconic, but she's iconic for stability, for seriousness, for responsibility, for duty, all admirable things, but not sexy things.
But she's globally iconic. If you say the Queen, you know, there are lots of
everybody
queens,
knows.
But everyone knows, as
you and I were talking about just the other day, not on the podcast, the fact that the Athelstan result was being reported in kind of Indonesian news websites saying, you know, the Queen didn't win. I mean, why would they care? They care because the Queen is iconic and is seen as a symbol of Britishness. And actually becoming a symbol of the nation is what the monarchy, I mean, that's the sign of success, isn't it?
And I think also that she has served as a kind of living reassurance to people that, you know, the country is still the country, that Britain is still Britain.
Yeah.
As people worry that they're not.
We're in danger of degenerating into a Channel 5 royal documentary.
Yeah, we are.
Let's move on. So we've got, they were the two semi-finalists. And then the final was Elizabeth and Athelstan, Elizabeth the First. We did do a podcast about Elizabeth the First with Tracy Borman earlier in this series. But let's just talk a bit about that clash, the Athelstan against Elizabeth the First. So that's, I mean, they're symbols, they're both symbols of Englishness. Athelstan was obviously a slightly sort of connoisseur's choice of, you know, people who are really interested in history, kind of like the Anglo-Saxons, partly because they're not well known, because they are a bit different. They're not part of the general sort of slightly tiresome cliches of English history. Whereas Elizabeth the First is absolutely the center of all the cliches of English history, isn't she? Define the Spanish Armada, Shakespeare, Drake, all of this sort of stuff. But ultimately, I think if this poll had been done by the general public rather than the rest is history listeners, surely Elizabeth the First would have won, wouldn't she?
I think so, yeah, I think so.
I mean, you can sort of tell that in the incredulity with which some news outlets reported it.
I mean, all I would say is that I don't think that anyone has any reason to hate Athelstan.
Vikings?
It's all such ancient history that even, you know, the Welsh aren't going to complain that he kind of bossed them around. The Scots aren't going to complain that he invaded Scotland. I mean, this is all so long ago. No one feels strongly enough about him, I think, to dislike him. There have been people who have quite strongly disliked Elizabeth.
But that's surely a bit sort of performative, isn't it? I mean, Elizabeth the First is not, by and large, a terribly divisive monarch.
Well, again, I was Jane Austen.
Yeah.
Huge fan of Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
A disgrace to humanity, she called Elizabeth. The destroyer of all comfort, the deceitful betrayer of trust reposed in her.
Well, at least that's not massively overstated.
No. Well, Jane Austen, famous for her excessive language.
Yeah.
And she is a queen during a period of you know, radical religious upheaval, of division. Her great achievement is to join Protestantism with patriotic English identity. That is something I think that is fading now.
In a reasonably unifying way, actually, Tom. At a time of enormous turmoil. I mean, you consider that what had preceded and then what was to follow in the next 100 years.
Completely. But I'm just saying that it is possible if you are, say, I don't know, Catholic or Irish, or both, that you don't necessarily see Elizabeth I as necessarily a great figure.
No, you don't. But you cannot deny she's a colossally effective figure.
I'm not. So, I'm not denying it. But I'm just saying that there are reasons, perhaps, why people vote against her.
Critics, even her critics, couldn't deny that she is a brilliant opportunist, a brilliant political survivor. The challenges facing her are absolutely colossal as a woman in a time of such religious turmoil, with Spanish hostility, the hostility of the greatest superpower, it's certainly in the Western world. She is up against it. And playing the Virgin Queen part and sort of Gloriana and the incarnation of Englishness is a brilliant, brilliant propaganda coup.
Well, we've said that this is all about whether you're iconic. And I mean, she's literally iconic. She kind of replaces the Virgin Mary in the affections, the symbolism
the
of
Virgin
England.
Queen, exactly.
England was famously devoted to Mary. She was, the devotion of the English to the Virgin Mary was celebrated.
Is it Walsingham, a church?
Our Lady of Walsingham. And Elizabeth brilliantly, brilliantly kind of usurps that role. Yeah. She steps into the Virgin's shoes, if you like. So she's absolutely, literally iconic in that sense.
Yeah.
Which is why she reached the final, why she was the number one seed, and why I think it was a big, global press attention focused on the stunning result of this, what I think has been our best World Cup.
Well, it's certainly been the one that people have got most excited about. I have a little bit of a soft spot for the Prime Minister's World Cup, I have to say. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
But do you think these things have they're an interesting insight into the minds of history buffs, I think. Do you think that's fair?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, certainly an interesting insight into the minds of our listeners on whom we
and ourselves.
We so depend.
We
I don't think we particularly influenced it.
Oh, come on. What, you were plugging your book on Athelstan from start to finish?
No, I wasn't. I might have mentioned it once, I think. But I wasn't as partisan as I was in the notorious ISIS Anubis.
No. Well, that was nice that we didn't have a repeat of that. Because at the end I was torn about Athelstan. On the one hand, I didn't massively want to promote your book more than you were doing already.
It's been agony for you.
But on the other hand, I sort of wanted him to win. Though I do think Elizabeth I, I'm not dissing Elizabeth I. I think she's deservedly a titanic figure in English history in a way that Athelstan actually isn't.
No, of course. Yeah. And that's why it's a big story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's all been great. We need, at some point, perhaps we'll do another historical World Cup.
Oh, we definitely
American
will.
Presidents, perhaps, or Caesars, or the worst kings and queens of England.
I mean, the worst kings, how would that vote? I mean, would you be voting for the least worst or the genuinely worst?
Today we'd have to decide. I mean, obviously, as presidents of this board of sport, that's up to us.
Yeah.
But something to look forward to.
Definitely. World Cups to come and great podcasts to come. We've got CIA coming up, haven't we? We've got Neanderthals. We've got Napoleon in Egypt. We have the Burgundians. And then we've got Christmas. We've got Dickens. We've got some more churches. We've got it all.
Don't go away.
No. See you then. Goodbye.